This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hi, thanks for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Hunter Thompson. Hunter is a full-time real estate investor and founder of Cashflow Connections. Since starting CFC, Hunter has helped investors allocate capital to over 100 properties, which have a combined asset value of more than $350 million. His experience includes investments in self-storage facilities, residential mortgage notes, mobile home parks, single-family acquisitions, hard money loans, office buildings, multifamily real estate syndications. In connection with these investments, he has worked with some of the most experienced and well-respected asset teams across the U.S. and Canada. Hunter, welcome to our show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Your voice sounds very young. So what? How old are you?
I am 32 going on 58.
Yeah.
Yeah, 32.
When I read that bio and I listen to the voice, I'm thinking, wow, that's a lot of experience for that age. How did you get started in real estate in the beginning?
Well, I think that, you know, timing of the market's really important, and part of that's just really luck. So for me, leaving college 2009, 2010, there was just an incredible opportunity in real estate. And so I've always been the kind of person that is certainly interested in looking left if everyone's looking right, and probably going to go left when everyone's looking right without even thinking about it. And that was kind of my entrance into real estate. I saw that there was blood in the streets and just was very interested in the asset class. But generally speaking, not only was there a complete deflation in prices, there was lack of liquidity in the sense that there was just incredible operating partners out there that had trouble raising capital for the first time. And so I was able to build relationships with some institutional quality sponsors and was really fortunate, not only in terms of the market timing, but also in terms of that lack of liquidity, which allowed us to have some, you know, big conversations early on. And eventually, as the track record was solidified, we built a business around that. And, you know, it's grown significantly since those early days.
You were 23 when you had this start, my gosh.
Yep, around that time period. And, you know, I'd like to say that it was all brains, but the reality was if I was just a little bit older, I was so drawn to real estate just because I liked the idea of finance. But, you know, if I was 5 years older, especially moving to California at that time, it would have been very challenging for me to understand what systems and processes were going to withstand a recession because everyone was making so much money. And so I try to be humble in the sense that I was fortunate not only in terms of market timing, but also when I started building a network, the people that I was building a network with in 2010, 2011, there were people that were able to weather the storm. And those early networking events were very somber, but it was filled with, later I would come to find out, some of the really influential people in the state of California and, you know, people that I modeled my career and my investment thesis off of.
This ability to go left when other people were going right, did you have a model for that, or is that just some gut instinct that you had?
Honestly, mostly just gut instinct. It's something that I was doing, you know, from a pretty young age, just looking for interesting opportunities and never really made much of a very good employee, but was always kind of with that entrepreneurship. That was kind of a bug that I always had. My introduction into finance, though, was not directly to real estate. It was originally just the stocks and bonds and mutual funds world. Was the marketing is so strong, that was where I was originally drawn. So when 2008 happened, you know, watching CNBC every single day, I originally thought there'd be an incredible opportunity in stocks. Now there was, but as I was really ironing out what my main financial goals were, most importantly, predictability of outcome and cash flow to pay off expenses. I think most investors, that's the real goal. When you start to ponder that, you look at stocks and they're just not a very direct way to accomplish those two goals. And so as I was looking at that, and starting to come to that realization, for most people, 2008 was kind of that last straw moment. For me, it wasn't until 2010. So I'd experienced some gains in stocks, as most people would, starting in 2008. But in 2010 is when the European debt crisis happened. And that's something that I don't think gets near enough attention. For me, this was a paradigm shift causing moment. So basically, there was, for those of you that don't know, that they're listening to this, the European debt crisis was very similar to what happened in 2008 in the United States, but with the European banks. there was a complete lack of liquidity in the market, and there were central banks that were having serious liquidity challenges. And this was causing massive volatility challenges in the U.S. markets. And I remember that watching CNBC, and they were talking about the Greece bond yields. And they were saying if the Greece bond yields remained below 7%, the S&P 500 was going to be fine. But if it went above 7%, the S&P 500 was going to collapse. And I basically was waking up at market timing trying to understand, how is it the case that after all this research that I've done, all these books that I've done, that something like the Greece bond yield is now playing a significant role in my financial well-being? And that was when I really had that complete moment where I just said, I've got to find a vehicle that is straightforward enough so that I can mitigate against these completely complex challenges that one single person or even a family office can't really understand.
So were you involved in the funding arm of other people's deals, or were you initiating the deals and then doing the funding?
So my position in the marketplace was really, I was just really drawn to the syndicated space generally. So my start in the business, and to a certain extent still how we're positioned as a company, being able to rely on experts' expertise through syndications, GP and LP structures, I was just very drawn to that because it allowed me to get that significant diversification across asset classes. So initially we were just investing, you know, I was investing my own capital and then started to help friends and family invest. And then as we ironed out a due diligence process, which was, you know, significantly above what a typical passive investor can conduct because the economies of scale, even if you're investing $200,000, you can't spend 100 hours on due diligence. You can't fly around the country looking at properties all over the place. It'll eat away at your returns. So we basically built a business around creating that system and then creating an infrastructure in which to take on additional investor capital. And so going from, let's say, 5 investors to 10 investors to now we have, let's say, upwards of 300, we leveraged the size of our investor group to get favorable terms from these operating partners and essentially joint venture with them, interface with investors so they don't have to, they can focus on the properties, and we can focus on telling the story, et cetera.
So you basically, at this point, you get a call with somebody that has an opportunity, and you guys become the funder of it and a partner of it. Is that pretty accurate?
Exactly. And there's kind of a value add on both sides of the equation, because most sponsors, they want to focus on making sure the supply-demand disequilibrium is correct. They want to make sure that the actual functional property managers are doing a good job. I really like interfacing with investors. I really like communicating with them, explaining the benefits of different asset classes, explaining downside protection, upside potential gains. And that's really the division of labor. And so when we come to a sponsor, we say, look, we are going to be proportionately easier to deal with than the several hundred investors that we represent. But at the same time, we issue distributions and executive summaries and the communication. So it just completely takes that off the table. But at the same time, investors get the benefits of investing with, you know, some institutional quality sponsors without having to source those relationships or make a bet on someone they've never worked with before.
Right. It's hard to have experience in all the product types that you're dealing with. So I myself have done a lot of investing, but it's really been mostly in the single family space. You guys are kind of covering a lot of territory. So what was your first product type that you funded, and how's that changed over the years?
Well, the first deals we ever did were hard money loans. And I think on a risk-adjusted basis, to be honest, I think that those were still some of the best investments I've ever made. Now, the rates, of course, have changed since those early days. But when I found out what a hard money loan was and said, I can give you $60,000 and you're going to put up $100,000 property as collateral, I felt like, wow, this is kind of a no-brainer. I can't believe everyone's not doing this. And then everyone started doing it and the rates came down significantly into a much more proportional way. So part of that, though, is during that process, I felt really compelled to commercial because of the complexities of the asset class. I think it lends itself more favorably to that passive approach. So with single family, for example, it's one of the most popular ways to invest in real estate because most people are more familiar with single family. The barrier entry is relatively lower. The investment amounts can be lower. You can control an entire property for a $30,000 down payment. With the self-storage business, for example, it's extremely complicated. And so with those complexities, does incur certain risks. But I think more importantly, there is a huge discrepancy between a mom and pop owner and a best-in-class owner. And that discrepancy then lends itself to the sponsor, the operating partner, taking a percentage of the gains that it generates, because that sponsor is then bringing much more to the table, if that makes sense. Basically, the complexity of the asset class lends itself to the passive approach just because the sponsor is adding so much more value, because mom and pop owners just simply don't have those systems in place. While single family, like I said, the simplicity means that you can control the risks because there's less moving parts. But the more moving parts, the more outsized the returns can be if you do have that significantly favorable or really experienced manager.
So when someone comes to you with a self-storage, not only are you capable of funding the money side, but you also have a clue to how to go from mom and pop to best in class, or is that incorrect?
Yeah, that's correct. And in my opinion, you know, everyone's looking for asymmetric returns, right? The disproportional return for a proportional risk or a lower risk. And I think that self-storage paints a good picture of that, because a lot of the returns can be generated by management expertise as opposed to something like capital expenditure. So I'll start with the reverse and back our way in. If you're doing something like expanding a commercial property by 50%, you're going to get, or should anticipate to get, a proportional increase in the risk and increase in the return profile, but you're incurring risk to generate those returns. But there are strategies in the self-storage business. So for example, we can buy a property based on in-place income that doesn't have a commission structure with U-Haul or another truck rental company. We buy that property based on the in-place income, and then within 30 days, we contact our contact at U-Haul. They park 5 to 15 trucks on our facility, and we rent out those trucks and get a commission for facilitating the transaction. I have personally invested in properties where that one line item has gone from $0 a month to $3,800 a month directly to the bottom line. And that's what I would consider to be an asymmetric return, in the sense that you're not buying those trucks, you're not maintaining those trucks, you don't even have to really interact much with those trucks, you're just facilitating the transaction. So it's a matter of that infrastructure already works. It's been successful across many properties, and it doesn't require a big investment. You buy the property and just implement it. And so that's one example. There are many in the self-storage business, again, because of those complexities.
Now, okay, how is the self-storage? I mean, it's become very common. So just give me a few key points to where when somebody brings you a self-storage, what would be some of the things that you would say, okay, this is not really the best setup?
Okay. In one thing that I'll kind of paint the picture behind the curtain, and we'll take a look what's under the hood, so to speak. So in the single family business or the multifamily business, you frequently hear people talk about replacement cost. And if you can buy a property below replacement cost, you know you're getting a good deal to a certain extent, because it's really challenging to compete with that product. Other people can't develop a property right next door and have comparable rents if you're below replacement cost. Well, you almost never hear that metric in self-storage. And the reason for that is that it's very inexpensive to build these products. They're simplistic, and the cost to build is very frequently much below the purchase price. And so people don't lead with that as a marketing component. So what you need to be very cautious about is the supply-demand disequilibrium in a particular market, especially within, let's say, a 5-mile radius. So one of the first things that we want to do is we want to identify markets that are completely undersupplied or significantly undersupplied. So if we're looking at a market and there's a 5-mile radius, the national average is about 7.7 square feet of self-storage per person. So if you're looking at a property that's in a market where there's only 3.5 square foot per person, that's likely an undersupplied market. Now, of course, there's many, many moving parts to that. Just a rule of thumb, that's a really good estimate of how desirable self-storage will be in that particular asset class. So if it's 250,000 square feet undersupplied, for example, that means that there could be 2 or even 3 properties built next door, and you'd still be able to raise rents aggressively and continue to see occupancies increase if you're able to manage effectively. So, you know, that's one. There's many. I mean, the key, though, is that you want to buy from mom and pops that are not doing things that businesses would be doing. I mean, from the smallest things, like we were doing due diligence on a property and the previous manager was renting out a pair of scissors to people that were moving and cutting boxes, as opposed to selling the scissors. Now, that example, okay, that maybe is costing them $15 a month or so in revenue. It's not that consequential, but from a optics perspective, you see things like that. There's many, many other things on that massive Excel sheet. Each line item is probably not being optimized, and that's really where the NOI can be generated.
So are you sometimes involved in the building of these from scratch?
You know, I don't think it's necessary at this point to incur that type of risk, because about 77% of the business is owned by, I wouldn't say mom and pop, but non-REITs. And a big portion of those are single asset owners, so mom and pop owners that don't really have those systems. So I think you can generate those returns without incurring the risk of development. But that development component, the fact that they're inexpensive to build, it means that there's pretty much always an opportunity in self-storage, because in certain markets, they will be overdeveloped. And then developers have problems raising occupancies. And then firms like us can come in and buy those properties, rent them up. And then it constantly goes in that cycle. And it's just a great vehicle, in my opinion, because of some nuances of the asset class as well as the tenant base.
Do you find that the rules of engagement change state to state, town to town?
Man, one of the benefits of it is that the regulatory burdens are quite low, because people aren't supposed to be living in them. There's been some problems with that in places like California. But because people aren't supposed to live in them, the laws basically are much more favorable. So you can do, there is variance in that, but usually anywhere between 5 and 30-day evictions for non-payment, because you're not really evicting someone. You're basically just locking the self-storage facility. And then if they want access to it, they pay for the late fees, et cetera.
Yeah, I've looked at those things with jealousy as I've opened mine up, thinking, wouldn't it be great to have a tenant with just a lock and a light bulb at best?
Right.
That's pretty great.
Right.
How do those compare to mobile home parks? And those are mostly existing mobile home parks that you might provide funds for?
Yeah, and good question. I'm a big believer in the mobile home park thesis. Now it's something that's much more in trend. We've seen a significant amount of cap rate compression because of that. But back in 2011, 2012, it was not as commonly talked about. And the paradigm has slowly shifted into now there's a lot of interest in the sector. But the key with mobile home parks, number one, the demand is inversely correlated with the overall economy. The worse the economy does, the more demand there is for affordable housing, and particularly mobile home parks. There's an interesting part of the asset class as well, is which there's less and less of them every single year. So you have a tremendous amount of demand, for the most part being driven by baby boomers that are relying on Social Security. And you have this increasing demand due to that demographic shift, but a contracting and a certainly stagnating amount of supply. And so that paints a unique picture from an investor's standpoint. With the type of business that we like to invest in, you actually just own the park itself rather than the home. So the tenant base owns the home, and therefore a lot more pride of ownership. In the multifamily sector, for example, you want people to treat the apartment like they own it. In the mobile home park business, they actually do. And so the pride of ownership is higher. Because of that, the expense ratio is lower. And again, a stable tenant base, at least in the types of assets that we like to invest in. Most of the horror stories you hear about the mobile home park business, they're in parks where the majority of the homes are owned by the park and the tenants are basically renting out the home. That is categorically different from the types of investments that we like to make. It's just a matter of preference, but I think the data is really compelling for that. So yeah, so just the difference between the types of business, like when you see things on TV that are about mobile home park businesses, the challenges that are associated with those, it's mostly from people that are renting the homes as opposed to those who buy the homes. And to me, that's a categorical difference.
So let's talk a little bit about due diligence, and we're going to do two segments, so we'll just touch on this. But one of the comments you made I found interesting: sometimes the best deals are the ones you don't do. So give me an example from your experience, one of those things that looking at it, you're really glad you avoided.
man, there's so many, and unfortunately, I see more and more. I mean, part of that is the fact that we've seen an incredible increase in the amount of investors involved in real estate. And we've simultaneously seen all this interest in the crowdfunding space, all this funding going to commercial and single family properties from new real estate investors, which, by the way, I think is incredible. I think that paradigm has shifted and it's a very good thing for the economy and for real estate. But you simultaneously have this massive run up in prices. And so now the question really is, all these new investors, have they experienced these gains because of their due diligence process and their expertise, or have they experienced it because of a once in a lifetime run up in prices? And so when I look at due diligence, that's really the key for who is going to succeed over the next 10 years. So to answer your question, there are so many deals out there that if these cap rates revert to their mean, there's going to be a major challenge with debt payments or refinancing, let's say. So, you know, generally speaking, interest rates are quite low, occupancies are quite high. Interest rates, like I mentioned, are low, but generally speaking, cap rates are also low. So you have, it's very hard to make the argument that we have much room to go. So if you look at some of these deals that are in the Midwest, for example, that are trading at five caps in markets that only 5 years ago were trading at 8.5 caps, you're going to have a debt piece that's going to give you enough time to recover from some sort of correction, or your underwriting is going to have to be very, very conservative, or you're not going to be able to execute. And so just looking at that right there, I mean, I can go into details in terms of particular deals, but I am right now at this moment extremely biased towards very sophisticated and expert and established sponsors. And that's not always the case, but just is right now, in the sense that in 2011, I was willing to take a little bit more risk on relatively new firms because I assumed that we had a lot of tailwind. Right now, I want to make a bet on firms that have a significant market advantage from a relationship standpoint and from an operational standpoint. Because when things go sideways, what you really need is a best friend. And I want to make sure I make a bet on someone that has a lot of best friends in the business.
Yeah, you made an interesting point. One of the things, you know, I speak once in a while in front of apartment owners associations, and the audience themselves being asked this question, would you buy your own apartment building at its current valuation? 400 people laughed. And that was an eye-opening experience for me, because I realized that they know all this stuff is at a cap rate that makes no sense. That doesn't mean they're going to sell it. It just means it probably is going to change.
Certainly. And it's a matter of setting expectations reasonably. But listen, and I know that you're sympathetic to this as well. Everyone that's talking about protecting principal, which is basically what should be the underlying thesis of most of your investments right now, the easiest way to get to the bottom of that is look at the debt portion. And that's something that I don't think gets enough attention. If more than half of the capital stack is debt, your due diligence should be proportionally focused on that. What is the debt service coverage ratio? What is the term? Is it fixed or floating? What are the repayment penalties? Those are the types of questions that I don't think are asked enough, because people are more focused on the return profile. And the debt is, when things go wrong, the debt portion is what really causes that loss of principal. Think about 2008. While 2008 was an aberration in terms of the significance of the downturn, it was not in terms of where real problems come from in real estate. If you invest in everything in land, the likelihood that you'll lose money is very, very mitigated. Excuse me, if you invest in cash, I should say, even if it's raw land, you have the capacity to sit there forever, like land tends to do in the downturn. But if you're holding it leveraged, then the whole dynamic changes.
Yeah. Now also you have, I would think, the attitude change of the lenders can get very aggressive. So what you mentioned was the ability to refi existing projects. Well, if you're in a cap rate market that's five or under, and all of a sudden you revert to a mean of 8.5, that LTV on your current loan probably is an unacceptable risk to a lender.
Absolutely. And actually, let me touch on the pace, because I've made some bullish comments about the self storage and mobile home park business, and I don't want the investors to get the impression that that's the only way I think about the business. You know, to your point, if something is going to come back in a problematic way in terms of refinancing, the real challenges that those two businesses faced in 2013 or 2012 or so is because of the lack of the buyer pool comparatively. So if you have a really quality property and in a really quality market, and you have a multifamily or single family property, you're going to find a lender for that property because there's just so many available lenders. Where these tertiary asset classes like mobile home parks and self-storage have challenges is when the buyer pool shrinks. When the economy turns around, everyone starts focusing on exactly what they know. And what they typically know is single family and multifamily. And so that's one of the things we want to be cautious about. It comes down to the debt. Now, we think that there has been a mitigating of that challenge because of the fact that there's so many investors now that are interested in mobile home parks in particular. But basically, the buyer pool has expanded significantly. And I think that that mitigates that challenge. But at the same time, one of the reasons that we entered into the space, those more tertiary asset classes, is going back to that look left when everyone's going right. Paradigms always are changing. You have to be on top of that. But one thing that doesn't change is that the importance of the debt component is critical. So hopefully that's at least one takeaway investors got if they're listening to this and made it through the 30 minutes.
Hunter, how do we take a look at what you're up to and maybe get a chance to work with you? So do you have a website that you can pass on, please?
Yeah, absolutely. And first of all, I just wanted to thank you again for having me on. It's an honor to be on. I've been a fan of yours for quite some time, and I know that you've put out a tremendous amount of incredible content for your listener base. So if listeners want to learn more about me, they can go to cashflowconnections.com. And if you're interested in the self-storage business in particular, I'd be happy to shoot you a free ebook on the topic. Just shoot me an email at info@cashflowconnections.com.
Okay. Hunter, thank you very much. I thought it was really a fascinating show because it's on all kinds of stuff I don't know about.
Rare thing indeed. All right. Thanks again, Bruce.
The Norris Group originates and services loans in California and Florida under California DRE License 01219911, Florida Mortgage Lender License 1577, and NMLS License 1623669. For more information on hard money lending, go to thenorrisgroup.com and click the hard money tab.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.